Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. Episode 23A, The War with Hannibal. Rome had laid its ultimatum at the feet of the Carthaginian Senate after Hannibal had laid siege to Saguntum in Spain. If the Carthaginians did not immediately recall Hannibal from the field and cease their aggressive operations, Rome would declare war. The Carthaginians declined to do as the Romans asked, and both sides immediately began to prepare for battle. The Roman consuls for the year, Cornelius Scipio, father of the famous Scipio Africanus, and Sempronius Longus, began to raise legions with the intention of simultaneously attacking both Spain and North Africa. But in Spain, Hannibal was making preparations of his own that would throw the Roman war plan into complete disarray. He formulated a bold strategy to break the Romans by way of a direct invasion of Italy. The Romans were worried about Gallic opportunism on their northern border, but did not anticipate a full-fledged Carthaginian invasion at all. Hannibal amassed a force of 90,000 infantry, 12,000 cavalry, and 67 war elephants at New Carthage, and in April of 218 BC, set out on a campaign that would ultimately last 17 years. His first task was to simply make it out of Spain. The Carthaginians only controlled about half the country, and the march to the Pyrenees was a difficult one. Hannibal had no time for prolonged sieges and was forced to directly assault the cities he passed, suffering heavy casualties as a result. Before passing into modern-day France, Hannibal released the less reliable elements of his Spanish infantry and passed into Gaul with a force of about 50,000. In Rome, Hannibal's movements passed without notice. Sempronius Longus was in Sicily preparing a fleet for the invasion of Africa, and Scipio was in North Italy raising a fleet of his own for the attack on Spain, neither suspecting that in a matter of months they would both be fighting for their lives in the icy sleet of the Po Valley. Scipio set out for Rome with two legions, and after 5 days at sea put into port at Massilia on the eastern banks of the Rhone River. As soon as he put in, though, he received word that not only had Hannibal broken out of Spain, but he had already reached the Rhone himself and was just a few miles up the road. Scipio was shocked by this development and immediately sent a cavalry unit out to investigate. Sure enough, they found Hannibal on the west bank of the river. A light skirmish of no consequence ensued that served only to alert Hannibal to the fact that the Romans were now officially onto him. He moved with all haste to cross the 1,000-yard-wide river, and was not helped by the army of angry Gauls on the opposite shore, who were not inclined to allow this foreign army into their territory. But Hannibal, flashing the first signs of his tactical brilliance, lured the Gauls into a trap and broke them apart with little difficulty. The way clear, he quickly crossed the remainder of his army and marched on towards the Alps, which were the only thing standing between him and Italy. When Scipio arrived with his legions, the fires of the Carthaginian camp were still smoldering, but the army was gone. The consul decided against a pursuit, which would have taken his two legions into an unknown and unfriendly territory to catch a much larger Carthaginian army. The odds were against Scipio, so he made the decision to send the legions on to their initial objective in Spain, while he himself returned to Italy to brace the northern border for Hannibal's invasion. The Roman plan to fight the war in Spain and Africa would move forward, but Scipio knew that the war was about to reach an early decisive moment and wanted to be on hand to ensure a favorable outcome. Hannibal's passage through the Alps is one of the most famous events in world history, and with good reason. Not only did the 15-day crossing come as the snow was beginning to set in, making traversing the peaks difficult and nearly impossible, but Hannibal's army was forced to constantly fend off bands of hostile natives. The passage would have been hard enough in a small, self-contained party, but Hannibal had to oversee 50,000 men and a supply train of pack animals. And did I mention that he had 67 elephants in tow? The logistical nightmares alone were enough to dissuade even the most daring of generals from even contemplating the attempt. And that's why the Romans were in disbelief when reports began to arrive that a Carthaginian army would shortly be emerging from the mountains. Hannibal fought one major pitched battle against the Gauls near the summit, and on the descent was forced to literally carve a path out of the rocks to accommodate the pack animals and elephants. His men spent night simply huddled around each other on the ground, trying not to drop dead from exhaustion or freeze to death. Supplies were low and hunger was high. But through it all, the personal magnetism of Hannibal kept his army together. For the most part, anyway. The army that emerged on the far side had been considerably reduced in numbers. Entering with 50,000, they came out the other side with a mere 25,000 remaining. A considerable chunk of those lost were casualties of the environment, and is a testament to how difficult the journey really was. But the majority were almost certainly deserters. Apparently, the force of Hannibal's personality was only so strong. Hannibal was able to briefly rest his troops, but the two Roman legions ostensibly in place to ward off the Gauls were on their way with Scipio at their head. It would not be long before the war would begin in earnest. The Romans had pressed for the war and were chomping at the bit to take on the Carthaginians, but, at least initially, the Second Punic War turned out to be a series of shocking defeats for Rome. The first battle was fought on the banks of the Ticinus, the largest tributary of the Po River. Scipio, eager to engage the invading Carthaginians, built a bridge across the river and crossed over to meet Hannibal. In the battle that ensued, the Romans matched up just fine with their infantry, but their cavalry was woefully inadequate in the face of their far superior Numidian counterparts. The Romans were outflanked and driven back to the bridge they had built. In the withdrawal, Scipio himself was wounded and was saved either by a slave girl or, as Livy recounts, his 18-year-old son, Scipio Africanus. Whether the younger Scipio saved his father or not is debatable, but there is no doubt that he was at the battle that opened the war he would ultimately win 16 years later. The Romans crossed back over the bridge and burned it to prevent the Carthaginians from pursuing. Scipio's goal had been to stop the invasion right then and there, but all he accomplished was demonstrating to the local Gauls that Hannibal was for real, and caused them to begin actively supporting the Carthaginian general. Scipio returned to his base on the far side of the north-south running Trebia River and sent out the call for reinforcements. Hannibal did not immediately press his advantage, but instead used the breathing space he had won for himself to reprovision, rest his exhausted troops, and accept Gallic reinforcements into his ranks. Sempronius Longus was called from his yet-to-be-launched invasion and ordered to take his army north to join with Scipio and engage Hannibal. It would be another decade plus before the Romans revisited the idea of invading Africa. The next month, Longus arrived with his army and combined it with the existing troops. Scipio cautioned rushing out into battle, having seen firsthand what a devastating force Hannibal was in the field. But Longus, impatient and no doubt suspecting that his colleague's injuries were behind his wariness for further battle, ordered the legions out to find and destroy the Carthaginians. It was now December, and the weather had turned from bad to worse. Wind, sleet, snow, and rain combined in a mixture of all the worst possible conditions you can imagine. The kind of weather that makes you not even want to check your mail, let alone fight a war. But Sempronius Longus was determined to end the invasion before the next consular elections. And just as in the case with Regulus in the First Punic War, the pressing need for battle was driven more by personal vanity than careful calculation. Hannibal played the Romans like a fiddle, and he manipulated Longus into a battle in which the legions were in the worst possible position to win. Catching wind of the change in leadership and the impatience of the newly arrived consul, Hannibal baited the Romans into a trap. Early in the morning of a particularly horrible day, Hannibal sent out a large contingent of his cavalry to attack the Roman camp. As soon as they appeared, Longus ordered the full force of his infantry out in pursuit. This hasty decision left the Romans without something Hannibal had hoped to deny them, a good warm breakfast. The Romans essentially rolled out of bed and charged off to fight. Compounding their hunger, Longus ordered them to immediately cross the Trebia, which in December is a swollen and freezing river. When they reached the other side, they found Hannibal waiting for them at the head of a well-fed, dry army. And as if this wasn't bad enough, Hannibal had hidden 1,000 cavalry behind an outcrop of rocks and brush. The Carthaginians drew the soaking and exhausted Romans away from the river, and as soon as there was enough space, Hannibal ordered the hidden troops onto the Roman rear. The battle was an unmitigated disaster for Rome. The only thing that allowed them to even salvage their dignity was the unquestioned superiority of the legions as a fighting force. About 10,000 managed to break through the Carthaginian line and make for Placentia, but the rest of the army was destroyed, either caught between the two Carthaginian lines or killed trying to recross the Trebia. Sempronius Longus escaped with his life, but left his reputation lying dead on the battlefield. Rome was now in a complete panic. According to the frantic rumors, the Carthaginians would come pouring into the city in a matter of days, and nothing could stop them. But luckily, the winter, despite Hannibal's cunning use of the weather to his advantage, was no time to launch a siege of Rome. And besides, launching a siege of Rome was not what Hannibal had in mind anyway. The Carthaginian army settled in for the winter, and the war was put on hold until the following spring. When spring arrived, the Romans raised fresh legions and sent them out to man the frontier and prevent Hannibal from making it any further south. The dominant consul for the year was Gaius Flaminius, a popular plebeian leader whose only major flaw was a maverick streak that did not endear him to the leading aristocrats, or, by some accounts, to the gods of Rome. When Flaminius was elected in 217, he did not return to Rome to oversee the religious ceremonies that accompanied the transfer of power, which speaks either to his noble disdain for the trappings of power, or a foolish irreverence that would lose him the favor of the gods. Whether it was luck, stupidity, or the active intervention of displeased gods, Flaminius was about to lead the legions to their greatest defeat, a defeat that shook the Romans to their very core and would leave them almost insane with fear. Luckily for Flaminius's legacy, though, the Battle of Lake Trasimene would only stand as the worst defeat in Roman history for a year, and Flaminius's failure would be overshadowed by Varro's far greater display of incompetence at Cannae. Sticking to his strategy of picking the most difficult routes of approach in order to surprise his enemy, Hannibal began 217 BC by marching through a swamp. The Romans had the roads covered, so Hannibal simply abandoned them. The four-day march through the flooded slog was an understandably miserable experience, and in many ways was more difficult than the passage through the Alps. There was literally no dry ground anywhere, and sleeping was a matter of sitting in muddy water and trying not to drown. Hannibal brought up the rear, riding an elephant, and making sure that the army understood the only way to move was forward. The general shared the pain of his men, though, his eyes having succumbed to an infection that would eventually lead to the removal of one of them. But because of the horrid swamp march, Hannibal accomplished his goal and successfully outmaneuvered the Romans. He was now deep in Etruria, and no army stood between the Carthaginians and Rome. Flaminius had no doubt that Hannibal's goal was to march uncontested on Rome, and immediately sent out at double time to catch the Carthaginians. But Hannibal, as I said, had no intention of attacking Rome. But he did have every intention of luring Flaminius into a trap, and he chose Lake Trasimene as the perfect site. Lake Trasimene is about 150 miles north of Rome, and its northern bank butts up against steep hills. Hannibal placed his infantry on the thin strip of land between the banks and the hills, and waited for Flaminius to come charging in the narrow entrance to the north bank. In the hills above and around the lake, Hannibal hid his cavalry and a good portion of his ground troops. When Flaminius arrived, he passed through the narrow entrance without a second thought, intent only on engaging Hannibal in battle. But as soon as his forces were through, the Carthaginian cavalry appeared and sealed up the entrance, trapping the legions. Flaminius was caught completely by surprise and was just wrapping his head around the fact that he was now fighting on two fronts when the rest of the hidden Carthaginian army came pouring down the slopes from above. The Romans didn't stand a chance. Of the 40,000 who entered, it is estimated that 30,000 were killed or captured, including the ill-fated Gaius Flaminius. Many drowned in a vain attempt to swim away from the slaughter. Hannibal stood over the dead and must have wondered to himself how the Romans could ever have conquered anything. Sure, they were strong, but from what Hannibal had seen over the last year, they were about as savvy as a rock. The way to beat the Romans, clearly, was not to outfight them, but to outthink them. Hannibal now held Italy in the palm of his hand, but his coup de grace was yet to come. Next week, we will begin with the worst disaster in Roman military history, the Battle of Cannae. The Romans, shocked by the succession of defeats at the hand of this emerging national nightmare called Hannibal, will be left nearly catatonic when they get word of what happened to the legions at Cannae. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. Episode 23b, The War with Hannibal. After the disaster at Lake Trasimene, the Romans were understandably frightened at what the future had in store for them. Every army they threw at Hannibal met with total destruction, and their once unshakable sense of invincibility had now been thoroughly shaken. It would only be a matter of days, it seemed, before the Carthaginian army would march on Rome and conquer the once mighty city. Optimism was in short supply, and lamentation flooded the market. In this depressed state, the Romans turned to an old psychological defense mechanism one last time to see them through the dark days ahead, the dictatorship. Unused since the First Punic War, and avoided in general since the heady days of the Samnite Wars, when a dictator seemed to be appointed every other year, the people of Rome turned their fates over, once again, to a single man. This time, the reins were handed to Quintus Fabius Maximus, the well-respected head of the well-respected Fabii. There would be one or two more temporary dictatorial appointments in the years to come, but the reign of Fabius Maximus would mark the effective end of the office of dictator. It was through no fault of his own, however. Rather, the office was rendered impotent by the people of Rome and fell into disuse. But it was Fabius who kick-started the demise of the dictatorship by ignoring the will of the people and acting like, well, a dictator. Fabius Maximus had a plan. It was not a popular plan. It was not a plan to win the war. It was not a plan to bring everlasting glory to Rome, and it was not even a plan that would bring everlasting glory to Fabius himself. It was a plan, however, that would ensure the survival of Rome. Fabius knew exactly what he was doing, and in the face of near-unanimous opposition, pursued his plan unswervingly, and because of his plan, the Roman Empire was not destroyed in 217 BC, as it very well could have been. The plan earned Fabius a place in the annals of military history by affixing his name to a certain kind of strategy, known forever after as Fabian tactics, or the fine art of avoiding battle. Fabius had watched with horror as the consuls of the previous years had been goaded into pitched battles at the time and place of Hannibal's choosing. The Carthaginian general had shown a singular ability to exploit the aggressive nature of the Romans to his own advantage. Fabius was determined not to make the same mistake. If he was going to fight Hannibal at all, he was not going to let the Carthaginian dictate the terms. But Hannibal was too savvy himself to be drawn into a battle he had not carefully orchestrated, so the upshot of Fabius's plan was that the two armies studiously avoided one another. But unfortunately for Fabius, studiously avoiding conflict was anathema to the Roman character. It was as if, in an effort to rejuvenate the Catholic Church, the College of Cardinals had elected an avowed atheist. The two just don't mesh well with one another. But whatever the merits of Fabius's plan, the outcry against him was immediately deafening, and many began to look to Fabius's master of horse, Marcus Rufius Minucius, for deliverance from what they saw as intentional cowardliness. Hannibal was laying waste to the countryside, and here Fabius was sitting on his hands and letting it go on. The only person who seemed to respect what Fabius was doing was Hannibal himself. When Fabius was dispatched against him, the Carthaginian general had attempted to set the legions up for defeat as he had done so easily before, but Fabius never bit at the traps. This left Hannibal in the driver's seat, and he pillaged the countryside with impunity, but it also left him without the opportunity to really lay a killing stroke on the Romans. Sure, he was causing a lot of havoc, but no matter how hard he tried to bait Fabius, the legions remained just out of reach and intact. The average Roman may not have fully understood what Fabius was doing, but the psychological benefit of simply keeping an army in the field was enormous. Days and months passed without news that yet another Roman army had been destroyed. Whether they appreciated it or not, Fabius was rebuilding Rome's confidence. The chorus against Fabius only grew louder as Hannibal, cunning as he was in politics as well as war, ordered that lands owned by Fabius be spared in the general pillaging, immediately leading to suspicions that Fabius had made a secret deal with Hannibal. But there was no deal, and Fabius, now and forever after nicknamed Fabius the Delayer, was simply biding his time until the right set of circumstances presented themselves. And when Hannibal marched his forces into Campania, Fabius saw his chance. It was only the genius of Hannibal, combined with a little luck, that saved the Carthaginian army from a decisive defeat by the Fabian legions. Without going too much into geography, the large valley of Campania has 8 passes big enough to allow an army the size of Hannibal's to march through. 5 of them were either held solidly by the Romans or lay behind the unfordable Volturnus River, leaving 3 possible exits for Hannibal from Campania. He had gone into the valley as part of his strategy to peel off Rome's major allies. The great city of Capua had risen to be the 2nd strongest in Italy behind Rome, and Hannibal believed there was a good chance he could flip Capua. And indeed, he would eventually succeed in his mission, though the Capuan revolt would not prove as decisive to the war effort as Hannibal had hoped when it finally occurred. The Carthaginian army, having entered Campania, proceeded with their standard MO of terrorizing the countryside, but before they knew it, Fabius had moved the legions into each of the 3 escape routes, trapping them in the valley. Hannibal knew he had been outmaneuvered and racked his brains trying to think of a way out of the trap. One night, a few hours before dawn, Roman sentries spotted a mass procession of torches and immediately raised the alarm. Hannibal was attempting to break through one of the passes under cover of dark. The Roman troops rushed out, determined to prevent Hannibal from escaping, but in so doing, they left the pass wide open, and when they reached the alleged column of troops and found only oxen with lit torches tied to their horns, they realized the enormity of their mistake. Hannibal led his army through the unguarded pass, and the Carthaginians got away. After this setback, Fabius was recalled to Rome to account for himself. The tribunes hurled every insult in the book at the dictator and convinced the people to support an unprecedented measure, the elevation of Minucius to co-dictator. This extra-legal solution was the death knell of the dictatorship as an effective office. The whole idea behind the dictatorship is that one man should have the final say over all policy without right of appeal. By elevating a co-dictator, the entire premise of the office was lost for good. If a dictator could be so easily rebuked by the people, then what good was even having one? You may as well just have 2 consuls. The semi-magical spell of dictatorial infallibility had been broken for good, and not until the time of Sulla 200 years later would the concept of dictator reappear with any real meaning. Minucius took command of half the army and marched towards Hannibal with typical Roman aggression. But, like all his predecessors, Minucius was outmaneuvered by Hannibal, and the legions under his command were almost wiped out. However, the much-derided Fabius, who watched from the nearby hills, decided he could not allow Minucius's forces to be destroyed, and against his better judgment, ordered his troops to the rescue of his beleaguered colleague. The addition of Fabius's troops turned the tide, and Hannibal was forced to withdraw. Minucius, humbled by his experience, immediately placed himself back into a subordinate position to Fabius. And the rest of 217 passed without any major battle. Fabius, despite persistent calls for his head, had managed to lead Rome through an entire year without a major defeat. Rome, however, would not learn from Fabius's success and clamored for leaders who would take the fight to Hannibal. In 216 BC, they got what they asked for, and for their trouble, got everything Fabius predicted, a defeat so massive it nearly ended the Roman Empire right then and there. The dominant figure to emerge during Fabius's dictatorship was a man named Marcus Varro, who denounced at every opportunity the cowardly policies of the wealthy patrician dictator. He promised the people that if they elected him consul, he would raise the largest army Rome had ever seen and crush Hannibal once and for all. The people responded by overwhelmingly supporting Varro for the consulship. His colleague for the year was the respected patrician Lucius Aemilius Paulus, who would play the superego to Varro's id. Together, they raised 16 legions of Romans and allies and marched southeast from Rome to find and destroy Hannibal. The Carthaginian army had taken over the small but important town of Cannae, or, as I have been incorrectly referring to it, Cannae, thanks to those of you out there who have knocked some sense into my Latin poor tongue. The Carthaginians were set up in Cannae, and the legions marched straight for them, 80,000 strong. Hannibal had just over 40,000 infantry and 10,000 cavalry, and despite his track record against the Romans, he had to be nervous at the sight of the massive force deployed against him. When the Romans arrived, a disagreement arose between the two consuls. Paulus did not like the look of the flat, open plain, fearing the destructive force of Hannibal's Numidian cavalry, and wanted to move the Roman forces into the nearby hills where the cavalry would be neutralized. Varro, however, saw the nearly 2-to-1 advantage the Romans held and immediately wanted to fight an infantry battle in the field and simply overwhelm the Carthaginians. When two consuls are present at the same site, there were two ways of dividing the command equally between them. One was to divide the army in half and give each consul total discretion over his half of the army. And the other, in force at Cannae, was for each consul to have total discretion over the whole army every other day. It was on Varro's day of command that the camps were built beside the plains, and it was on Varro's day of command that the battle was initiated. And there was nothing Paulus could do about it. On the morning of battle, as I said, Varro was in charge. He ordered the army across a shallow river to where the Carthaginians were lining up for battle, Hannibal hoping to get the Romans to bite at a battle he could control with his superior mobile cavalry wings. Lining up the Romans for battle, Varro followed the conventional three-line maniple alignment, but when he saw the way the Carthaginians were lining up, he made a critical decision to pack his troops close together and eliminate the checkerboard space between the maniples. His hope was to drive through the weaker Carthaginian infantry, divide Hannibal's army in half, and use the superior Roman numbers to annihilate the Carthaginian army. But this left the Romans open to an easy flanking maneuver, the same mistake Regulus had made in his battle with Xanthippus outside of Carthage during the First Punic War. Varro's mistake was doubly compounded by the fact that Hannibal had deliberately lined his army up to lure the Romans into just such a trap. The Carthaginian line was deployed in a semicircle, with the front closer to the Romans than the wings. In the center were placed the weaker Spanish and Gallic soldiers, which is what made Varro lick his lips and bunch the legions together. On the wings were the cavalry, and between the cavalry and the center were the Libyan infantry. After eyeing each other and letting the light skirmishers do their thing, Varro ordered the legions to attack. At first, things seemed to be going great for the Romans. The Spanish and Gallic soldiers were no match for the Romans, and were pushed back easily by the reinforced Roman lines. However, caught up in the heat of battle, the Romans did not notice that it was the center, and the center only, they were pushing back. The Libyans remained where they were, and pretty soon the curve of the Carthaginian line had been inverted, with the Libyans now forward of the center. The Romans continued to charge ahead, and before they knew it, the Libyans had outflanked them, even though they had not yet moved a muscle. The Romans were now hemmed in and suddenly found themselves fighting on three fronts. In the confusion, they were just beginning to work on extracting themselves from what was turning into a bloodbath when Hannibal closed the trap. His cavalry easily drove off their Roman counterparts and then wheeled around on the Roman rear. The legions were now completely surrounded and, having been placed so close to one another by Varro at the outset of the battle, were in many cases unable to even lift their arms up to defend themselves. At a minimum, 50,000 Romans died in the slaughter, with estimates going so high as 70,000. These totals included the cream of the Roman leadership, 29 military tribunes and 80 men of senatorial rank, including the former master of horse, Marcus Rufus Minucius. The consul Paulus, who never wanted the battle in the first place, was knocked from his horse and refused the offer of another to escape, choosing to die in the field than face the humiliation of surviving such a horrendous defeat. Varro, however, upon whose head the entire debacle rested, had no such qualms about his honor and fled for his life. The Battle of Cannae has gone down as one of the most famous battles in history. Generals are always looking to emulate Hannibal's near-perfect destruction of the Romans. Eisenhower referred to Hannibal's plan as a work of art, and as recently as the First Gulf War, General Norman Schwarzkopf modeled some of his attacks after Hannibal's formation at Cannae. Though the total envelopment is not nearly as impressive when you're commanding a much larger and more powerful army, it still shows how much this single battle has penetrated the collective consciousness. Despite the universal praise of Hannibal's genius on the battlefield, what the Carthaginian general did with his victory is the source of the harshest criticisms against him, leveled both by his contemporaries and the judgment of history. Because what he did with his stunning victory was absolutely nothing. It is easy to say that Hannibal should have immediately marched on Rome and taken the city rather than hold off and continue his policy of attempting to turn Rome's allies against them without actually going near the capital. But even in its weakened state, Rome itself would have been more than a match for Hannibal and his paltry army of 35,000. But it is impossible to say for sure. We have no way of knowing what would have happened if Hannibal had gone for the gold. All we do know is that he didn't. Whether this was because he didn't think he could pull it off, or because he didn't believe a direct assault on Rome was a necessary part of his greater plan, is also a matter of endless speculation. In the full light of history, though, we know that Cannae marked the high point of Hannibal's career. Whether he could have gone even higher by marching on Rome will never be known for sure. The Battle of Cannae closed the first stage of the Second Punic War. Hannibal would never again be so successful, and in the following decade, the fortunes of war would turn against Carthage in favor of the Romans and their young rock star general, Scipio Africanus. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. After the utter devastation of Cannae, no one would have blamed the Romans had they just given up. The history of the world could have very easily read something like, "But after the defeat at Cannae, the Romans surrendered. They had been beaten soundly over and over again by Hannibal, and on their own turf, no less. The Romans agreed to terms, and their just recently acquired empire was shattered." Next week, on the History of Carthage, we'll talk about Hannibal's falling out with Philip and the war in the East. But despite the obvious rationales for quitting the fight, Rome's determination to carry on was only bolstered by their defeats. The old Roman obstinacy was back with a vengeance. That special blend of honor, pride, and masochism that had seen the Romans through so much would see them through this, their darkest hour, as well. That is not to say the Romans proceeded through their trial unchanged. On the contrary, the early years of the Second Punic War fundamentally altered life in Rome. It was simultaneously and paradoxically a time of both democratization and consolidation of power in the hands of the elites. Popular agitation and rival political factions had sent out field commanders with diametrically opposed aims, and the confused Roman strategies had been easily exploited by Hannibal. The case of Fabius and Minucius presaged the much greater catastrophe that befell Varro and Paulus. But after Cannae, the Senate took control of the war, intent on prosecuting the conflict with something resembling a consistent strategy. The tribunes and the popular assemblies were shut out. The need for quick and coherent policies made the slow-turning wheels of democracy not just obsolete, but dangerous. The passions of the mob had sent Varro riding off to an ill-conceived battle that nearly destroyed the empire. The Senate was dead set against letting that sort of thing happen again. The elite seized control, and for the most part, the people were content to go along. But at the same time the seizure of power was going on, the opportunities for political advancement had never been so readily available. The sons of the great patrician families were strewn across the battlefields of Italy. These young men, who would have filled the leadership positions for a generation, were all dead now. Rome needed praetors and aediles and military tribunes, anyone patrician or plebe who showed a little initiative and bravery was liable to find himself given commands he otherwise could never dream of. The Second Punic War was, by necessity, a time of great turnover in the leadership class, and it was based, again, out of necessity, on merit rather than blood. During this period, the cream rose to the top, and Rome was well served for embracing the transition. So yes, the elites took control, but it was a merit-based elite, open to all. Despite the plausibility that some in Rome would have been more than willing to talk peace with Hannibal, the histories don't mention any internal conflict over what to do, even to vilify some chicken-hearted minority who wanted out of the war. It seems that on the subject of surrender, the Romans were of one mind, and they weren't about to do it. So they re-raised legions from their seeming endless supply of manpower, though, admittedly, it was not as easy as before. They had to both lower the youngest eligible age and raise the oldest eligible age, and, in an unprecedented move, purchased 8,000 slaves from their various citizen owners and enrolled them into an army of their own under the command of Tiberius Sempronius Gracchus, the great uncle of the famous Gracchi brothers, who we will get to in a few weeks. Hannibal's response to his smashing victory at Cannae was, as I said last week, to do nothing. He did not march on Rome and really force the Romans to think about what they were doing. Instead, he returned to his strategy of cutting the Romans off from their allies. And across the extended communication lines of the Mediterranean, Hannibal stayed in contact with his brother Hasdrubal in Spain, and they agreed that Hasdrubal should continue to press against the Romans in Iberia to prevent those stationed there from returning to Italy to fight. The hope was to make the Romans fight for their territory outside of Italy, while Hannibal made them fight on the peninsula itself. The Carthaginian brothers hoped to split the attention of the Romans in order to conquer them. Retaking Sicily in particular burned in the minds of both, as their father had been forced to leave the island not, as the brothers believed, because he had been bested in the field, but because he had been abandoned by Carthaginian politicians. The history of the stabbed in the back theory stretches, as you can see, far back into antiquity. And in 216 BC, just after the Battle of Cannae, fate stepped in to deliver the island to the Carthaginians. Hiero, king of Syracuse and stalwart ally of Rome, finally died after 53 years on the throne. He was succeeded by his grandson, Hieronymus, who had just turned 15. Though the old king had never faltered in his allegiance to Rome, a large bulk of the nobility was all for breaking away to the Carthaginians, especially after Cannae. When Hieronymus ascended to the throne, the impressionable youth was easily persuaded to invite the Carthaginians onto the island. A treaty was quickly concluded which promised aid to Carthage in return for staying out of internal Sicilian affairs. The young king immediately began operations against the remaining Roman legions on the island. But Hieronymus proved himself to be the prototypical depraved child tyrant, and his wanton displays of arrogant despotism soon raised the ire of many a Syracusan. There was still a sizable pro-Roman population within the upper class, and while Hieronymus was out on campaign, they had him assassinated, much to the relief of the general public. However, the conspirators then badly overplayed their hand and murdered the rest of Hiero's popular family and turned public opinion right back against them. Two Carthaginian generals who had been sent to the island to advise Hieronymus were raised up by the Syracusan soldiers and thrust into a position of supreme command. They returned to Syracuse at the head of the army and ousted the pro-Roman leaders of the coup. Suddenly, just like that, a pair of Carthaginian generals were in control of Syracuse, and Sicily was back in the hands of Carthage, just as Hannibal dreamed it would be. News of this unexpected and fortuitous turn of events was music to the ears of Hannibal in Italy and Hasdrubal in Spain. While Hannibal marched south to try and break the already shaky Roman allegiance of Magna Graecia, Hasdrubal attempted to coordinate a campaign against the Scipione brothers. Publius and Gnaeus Scipio, the father and uncle of Scipio Africanus, however, were proving to be more than a match for the Carthaginian army sent against them in Spain. Though Hasdrubal was ostensibly in overall command there, there were three Carthaginian armies in the field, and each general had his own idea about what ought to be done and who ought to receive the glory for driving the Romans out of Spain. Plus, the loyalty of the Spanish mercenaries was always in doubt, as they made for the hills any time there was real trouble. Nearly 5 years would pass without either side gaining much of anything in Spain. The Scipiones did manage to take back Saguntum, the city that had started the war, but beyond that, not much land changed hands. The Scipiones were making all the right moves, and in the tradition of Fabius, avoided decisive battles that might knock them out of the fight. As much as the Carthaginians were intent on dividing Roman attention, it was the Romans who were getting the better of splitting the theaters of focus. Hasdrubal was looking to dispatch the Scipiones and make for Italy himself to meet up with Hannibal, but the Romans were not going quietly into that good night. But then, in 211 BC, the Scipiones made an ill-advised strategic decision that would bring them both to ruin. Bolstered by 20,000 Celtiberian mercenaries, the 30,000 Romans in Spain found themselves in a position where they outnumbered two nearby Carthaginian armies, including the force commanded by Hasdrubal. The Carthaginians had roughly 35,000 men at their disposal, and the Scipiones decided time was ripe to punch out the Carthaginians. They split their own army, with Gnaeus leading about a third of the Romans and all the Celtiberians against Hasdrubal, while Publius led the bulk of the Romans against the other Carthaginian army. But, unbeknownst to the Roman generals, the army Publius was attacking was in the process of being reinforced, and the Celtiberians under Gnaeus' command had been bribed to desert at the outset of any battle. So, rather than having the advantage on both fronts, the Scipiones were outnumbered everywhere. Publius arrived at his objective first, but after some confused night fighting and the surprise arrival of a large contingent of Numidian cavalry, the Romans were pushed back and then broken. Publius Scipio himself was killed in the fighting, while only a small number of his army managed to escape. Unaware of what had happened to his brother, Gnaeus approached Hasdrubal with confidence. The Carthaginian stalled for time until he was sure that things in the north were unfolding according to plan, and then formed up for battle. Gnaeus ordered his men out and was horrified to find the Celtiberians, good to their word, at least in this case, immediately deserted. Left with only about 10,000 troops, Gnaeus didn't stand a chance. He oversaw one of the great last stands in history, fortifying a hopeless position with saddles and backpacks, and fighting it out to the last man. In the span of a few days, both Roman commanders and the bulk of the legions in Spain lay dead, and 5 years of careful campaigning had been for naught. Now I know what you're thinking. How is it that the Romans lost every decisive battle and still managed to win the war? Well, I'll tell you. They didn't lose every decisive battle in the war. In fact, at the same time the Romans were losing in Spain, they were winning in Sicily. Back on the island, the Romans sent Marcus Claudius Marcellus to reinforce the two legions already stationed on the island at the time of Hiero's death. These numbers included the survivors of Cannae, who were forced to serve in exile in Sicily without leave or any hope at all, really, of returning home. Broadly speaking, the troops who survived Cannae did their best to die in battle, where they could at least reclaim some of their lost honor. Marcellus's orders were simple. Take back Sicily and regain control of the vital food supplies Rome needed to survive, with Hannibal off ravaging the Italian countryside. Marcellus immediately ordered a siege of Syracuse. The city had yet to be taken by an invading army and had repelled all comers quite handily over the years. But Marcellus was intent on conquering the unconquerable city. His first attempt, though, failed spectacularly, just as had all the others. The ace in the hole of the Syracusans was their great mathematician, physicist, astronomer, inventor, and all-around super genius, Archimedes, who designed a number of defensive weapons for the city to help repel invaders. For the current war effort, Archimedes had designed grappling hooks that could be lowered from the walls and effect risk-free devastation on Roman naval assaults, as well as catapults that launched ridiculously sized boulders at the Romans with ease. It should come as no surprise to anyone that the great scientist died at the hands of a Roman soldier after the city was taken. Repelled in his initial assault, Marcellus settled in to starve the city out. 2.5 years would pass before the stalemate was broken. A group of pro-Roman nobles slipped through the lines and arranged to betray the city into Roman hands. The Romans timed an attack to coincide with a local festival and managed to scale the walls and take control of most of the city before they were detected. The Carthaginian generals in charge retreated behind an inner wall, holding up in the citadel of the city. Another stalemate ensued. The Carthaginians attempted to relieve the city by sending a number of fleets, but a combination of foul weather and Roman interference kept most help away. To make matters worse, a plague swept across Italy in 211 BC, decimating the Carthaginian army looking for an opportunity to aid the Syracusans and bringing those trapped inside to their knees. After being abandoned by the Carthaginian generals, those still holding out inside the city surrendered, and Marcellus claimed Syracuse for Rome. Then, in an uncharacteristic display of barbarism, Marcellus turned his troops loose on the city with permission to haul off anything they could. It was in the course of this looting that Archimedes was killed. The sack of Syracuse shocked even the Romans, who still looked with reverence on the great Greek city and were horrified to hear how poorly its citizens, art, and treasure had been treated. However, they were not so torn up that they did not celebrate an ovation for Marcellus upon his return to Rome. So we'll leave Rome on an upbeat this week after ending the last two episodes with devastating Roman defeats. Even though they had lost the initiative in Spain, they had turned the situation in Sicily around and secured most of the island once again for Rome. Next week, we will return to Italy and trace the movement of Hannibal during these years and follow the Romans as they followed Hannibal around and flip back cities Hannibal had flipped to the Carthaginian cause. There were few out-and-out battles between the two armies, just a lot of territory swapping and internal political machinations between rival factions inside the Italian cities. We will also introduce next week young Scipio Africanus, who would take command of the situation in Spain and attempt to avenge his father's defeat there. Only 25 at the time, he was given the command at this unprecedented age not because he displayed any great ability or seemed to be the savior of Rome, but rather because he was the only one who volunteered for the job. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. Episode 23D, The War with Hannibal. Last week, we detoured out of Italy to cover the Second Punic War and its two foreign theaters, Spain and Sicily. This week, we will return to Hannibal's march through Rome's backyard and attempt to distill 10 years of complicated allegiance switching, threats, revenge, and posturing into a single podcast. Well, actually half a podcast, because we must also return to Spain with young Scipio Africanus to pick up the ball where his father and uncle had left it. By the end of today, Scipio's ascendancy will intersect with Hannibal's slow decline, and the stage will be set for the final act of the Second Punic War, played out not in Italy as Hannibal planned, but in North Africa. But before we get to our two main focuses today, we need to detour into the third major foreign theater of the war. Though critically important to the war effort, the struggle with the Macedonians in the east has thus far received little attention, because for the most part it featured Greek allies fighting on behalf of Rome, rather than the Romans themselves, and also because the war in the east served mostly to keep Philip V out of the war, rather than unfolding as an integral part of that war. Though inextricably linked to the war with Hannibal, the First Macedonian War was, in many ways, a completely separate animal. It is important not so much in the context of the Second Punic War, but as a stage setter for the next 50 years of Roman history, which will revolve around the Roman conquest of Greece. Not long after Cannae, Hannibal and Philip V of Macedon signed a formal treaty with one another and pledged mutual support against each other's enemies. Philip was the young leader of a newly resurgent Macedon, who had visions of reuniting Greece under Macedonian rule, as his namesake Philip II, father of Alexander, had done. Rome, which had played no part in Philip II's calculations, now loomed large in Philip V's. The Romans were already entrenched in Illyria, and despite their claims of merely temporary occupation, they showed no signs of leaving. After the disaster at Cannae, Hannibal made formal overtures to the Macedonian king, and Philip accepted at once. The deal would leave Philip in control of Rome's eastern territory when Hannibal inevitably won the war, and provide Philip a steady Carthaginian supply line for his planned move against the rest of Greece. It also cemented a mutual sphere of influence that allayed both sides' fears of territorial encroachment. Deal in hand, Philip's envoys returned to Macedon, but on the way across the Adriatic, they were captured by the Roman navy. Immediately recognizing the danger of Hannibal's eastern alliance, Rome was forced to turn its already divided attention to one more front. But without troops to spare, they sent a scant force of about 2,000 with orders to not simply engage Philip, but instead to drum up Greek support for Rome and attempt to get the Greeks to fight Philip for them. This turned out to be easier than they thought. The Greeks were not happy in the slightest about Philip's ambitions, and despite their own prejudice against the barbaric Italians, they recognized the Romans for what they were, a force that could help blunt Macedon's influence. Specifically, Rome found a receptive audience in the Aetolian League, a confederation of cities that stood between Macedon and Greece proper. Knowing they would be among the first swallowed by Philip's territorial ambition, the Aetolians embraced Rome as their road both to continued independence and also possible dominance in a post-war Greece, and agreed to help counter Philip any way they could. The Macedonian king had his eye on driving the Romans out of their coastal garrisons in Illyria so he could establish a port from which to launch attacks into Italy. The Aetolians agreed to launch incursions into Macedon every time Philip tried to turn west. So, whenever Philip left for Illyria, the Aetolians would begin making trouble. The 10-year war of skirmishes is today, in the context of Roman history, called the First Macedonian War. But that makes more of it than it really was. It was the Second Macedonian War that really marked the first time the Romans moved east and fought the Greeks directly. Though it was not a direct engagement between the Romans and Macedonians, and won the Romans no territory, the battle in the east between the Macedonians and the Roman allied Greeks served the function it was meant to. It kept Philip out of the war with Hannibal. And this being the final upshot of all that fighting, we will leave it at that and return to the greater war at hand. One of the most important consequences of Hannibal's victory at Cannae was the decision by the nobility of Capua, the second most important city in Italy, to defect to the Carthaginian side. Hannibal expected this defection to be followed by the rest of Italy, but it was not meant to be. Capua's alliance with the Carthaginians did not sway the rest of Italy, as Hannibal, and no doubt the Capuans themselves, hoped that it would. Rather than putting them in the vanguard of history, Capua actually found themselves immediately isolated and recognizing that they may have bought high on Hannibal's stock. Certainly Capua's experience for the rest of the war was not a happy tale of preparing to rule Italy with Carthaginian backing, but instead a sad tale of enduring a Roman siege, finally begging for forgiveness, and ultimately a whole lot of beheadings. But for now, it was all still sunshine and roses for Hannibal. With Capua in his back pocket and Syracuse recently brought into the Carthaginian fold, Hannibal marched south to Magna Graecia with high hopes. The apex of Carthaginian momentum came in 212 BC when Hannibal won control of the rich Greek port city of Tarentum. The pro-Roman party in the city was ousted by a group of young nobles who handed the city over to the Carthaginians. The moment fortune turned against Hannibal was there at Tarentum when, as he marched into the city, the Roman garrison stationed there fought its way into the citadel and held it. The citadel at Tarentum was situated on the coast and could be supplied independently of the rest of the city. Hannibal was never able to dislodge the garrison and so was denied a safe Italian port through which he could resupply his invasion force. This would prove critical down the road as the Carthaginian Senate was loath to send supply ships and men to reinforce Hannibal when there was no guarantee they would even reach him. Up until Tarentum, almost nothing had gone against Hannibal. This was the first time things hadn't gone exactly according to plan. Annoyed by this thorn in his side, Hannibal's attention was forced back north to Capua, where his new ally was under siege by Roman forces. After Cannae, the Roman grand strategy abandoned any hope of taking on Hannibal directly. They had by now touched that hot stove enough to recognize that it burned. So, rather than sending an army south to confront Hannibal, they laid siege to Capua and attempted to flip them back to the Roman side instead. If any of you out there have ever played the ancient Chinese board game Go, you are probably familiar with the proverb, when in doubt, tanuki, which translates roughly, when in doubt, ignore your opponent. Good advice, and the Romans were wise to take it. By attacking Capua, the Romans forced Hannibal into a position where he was reacting to Roman moves, rather than the Romans reacting to his. Rome, for the first time in the war, held the initiative. Hannibal attempted to respond in kind to the Romans by embracing the concept of Tanuki himself, and rather than making for Capua, he drove instead for the one city he had studiously avoided, Rome itself. In 211 BC, Hannibal marched within 2 miles of the city, the closest he would ever get to Rome, and waited for the Romans to fly into a panic, lift the siege at Capua, and come running home. But the Romans did not bite at the obvious gambit. They knew Hannibal's army was not nearly strong enough to take Rome by force, and so they only broke off a portion of their siege army to reinforce the city. Capua remained under arms and growing more desperate by the day. His bluff called, Hannibal was forced to withdraw. The pro-Carthaginian leadership of Capua, abandoned now by Hannibal, was overthrown by pro-Roman forces and the city surrendered. The penalties for treason were harsh, and the aforementioned beheadings commenced with bloody abandon. Though in typical Roman fashion, their fury was directed at the leadership, not the city as a whole, and the sanctions imposed on Capua were light compared to the stress their defection had put on the Roman war effort. One of the main reasons I began the history of Rome in the first place was to distill the often mind-numbing minutiae of the ancient historians into digestible chunks. Specifically, the middle years of the Second Punic War is a period that cries for summarization. Livy fills hundreds of pages detailing every lost city, every betrayal, every conversation with every political faction, and every minor skirmish. The information is out there for those of you who would like more detail, but I now offer with great relish a paragraph I have been kicking around in my head for the better part of a year. The experience of Capua and Tarentum was repeated ad nauseum over the next few years. Hannibal would take a city and then move on. The Romans would follow behind and return it to the Roman fold. Hannibal would then be forced to either backtrack and refight for land he had already taken, or give up what he had gotten and hope for better luck the next time around. The two armies occasionally came into direct contact. Sometimes Hannibal would win, sometimes the Romans would. But victory no longer took the form of annihilated armies, but rather strategic withdrawals and prudent retreats. In this way, 5 years passed. Beautiful. That said, I now want to shift gears and move out of Italy and back to Spain, where, after the defeat of the Scipione army, it looked for all the world as if the Romans would never regain their footing. Certainly, no Roman general was eager to take up the difficult task in Spain. All that remained in Iberia was the bare remnants of the defeated legions, a horde of Carthaginians and hostile Spanish tribes. Officially, Rome had no intention of giving up in Spain, but practically speaking, they were about to do just that. Into this leadership vacuum stepped a young man, Scipio Africanus, who was destined to become a towering figure in Roman history. In the lineage of truly great, great Romans, the short list begins with Romulus, passes to Camillus, and then passes to Scipio, perhaps the greatest of them all. It was not until Julius Caesar 250 years later that Rome would again see a man with the stature of Scipio Africanus. Now, of course, he was not called Scipio Africanus at this point. He was still simply Publius Scipio, son of Publius Scipio the Elder. He would not earn the cognomen Africanus until after he returned from Zama, having won the Second Punic War for Rome. But that was still a ways in the future. At this point, he was an untested youth of barely 25, who impetuously stepped forward into the Senate and offered to take up the command in Spain if nobody else would. The Senate was not crazy about the idea, but under the circumstances, they figured they had nothing to lose. It was essentially take a chance on Scipio or admit defeat in Spain. So to Scipio went the command. Now, it was not just his youth that worried the old Roman guard, but the personality of Scipio in particular. Old war horses like Fabius did not like the look of young Scipio one bit. For one thing, he had, horror of horrors, long hair like a woman. For another thing, he had a distressing habit of talking as if he personally spoke to the gods and was acting on their behalf. In later years, he would often return from long strolls and announce battle plans as if they had been given to him by Mars himself. Finally, and most troublesome of all to the keepers of tradition, traditions Scipio seemed to delight in flouting, he was enormously charismatic. Scipio represented a changing of the guard, and despite his success, or perhaps because of it, he was looked upon with real fear by his elders. He was an incredibly magnetic cross between Jim Morrison, Alexander the Great, and Jesus. For those looking to keep things exactly as they are, a figure like that leads to many a sleepless night. But Scipio's flouting of tradition was the key to his success. He and old Fabius agreed on one thing, however. The Roman legions, presently constituted, were no match for the Carthaginians. But where Fabius read this to mean the Carthaginians should not be fought directly, Scipio read it to mean that the Romans had to fundamentally alter their tactics. Hannibal beat the Romans over and over again with cunning and imagination. So where the Romans had previously shown nothing but uninspired plotting, Scipio hoped to give the Carthaginians a taste of their own medicine and outthink his opponents rather than simply try and outfight them. He arrived in Spain with 10,000 men in 210 BC with vague instructions to regain lost Roman territory. But Scipio had no intention of simply fighting a defensive war. His long-term goal was to end the war completely and saw Spain as his proving ground. If he succeeded here, the Senate might offer him overall command of the legions and allow him to pursue his real dream of invading North Africa and conquering Carthage. There was no way he could convince the conservative Senate today, but if he drove the Carthaginians out of Spain, he just might gain their ear. After spending his first year in Spain getting a feel for the land and the locals, he embarked on an audacious assault of the largest, strongest, and richest of the Carthaginian strongholds, New Carthage. The three Carthaginian armies still out in the field had no idea the new Roman commander would attempt such a suicidal move. But the element of surprise was the element Scipio coveted most, and so he did the last thing anybody would expect of him, and ordered his army to march on New Carthage. Not even his subordinate commanders knew their true destination. The only other Roman who was in on the plan was a close Scipio confidant named Laelius, who commanded the Roman navy in the area. He was ordered to make for New Carthage and simultaneously attack from sea as Scipio engaged from the land. The small garrison at New Carthage was shocked when the Roman navy appeared on the horizon, and was doubly shocked when a Roman army came marching over the hill. The nearest Carthaginian army was days away, more than enough time, Scipio felt, to take the city and fortify it before reinforcements could arrive. He attempted a direct assault on the first day, but was repelled. That night, he received a critical piece of intelligence. A local pointed out that at certain times during the day, the lagoon that bordered one of the walls of the city drained out with the tides and became shallow enough to ford. The next morning, Scipio ordered a full assault on the front gate, and the defenders of the city concentrated all their attention on that spot. Scipio himself led a small contingent through the shallow and unwatched lagoon and scaled the walls. They easily overpowered what resistance they found, and when the Romans suddenly appeared behind the troops defending the wall, the Carthaginians panicked and broke for the citadel, allowing Scipio to open the gate and let the rest of his army in. It was only a matter of time before the unprovisioned force in the citadel was forced to surrender. In about 36 hours, Scipio had captured the Carthaginian capital. In a savvy move designed to gain Spanish support, Scipio released the members of the various local ruling families who had been held by the Carthaginians as hostages. By this one act alone, Scipio did more for the Roman position in Spain than all the battles in the world ever could. The Carthaginians were immediately on the defensive and found their Spanish allies deserting in droves. But Scipio, as I said, had no intention of staying put and fighting a defensive war. Leaving a garrison behind to protect the newly conquered city, he marched out with the rest of his army in search of Hasdrubal, Hannibal's brother and the architect of the Scipio's family dishonor. In 208 BC, Scipio caught up to Hasdrubal and fought a running battle against the Carthaginians in the middle of Spain. Hasdrubal, however, managed to slip away and lead his army northwest to the Atlantic coast. Hannibal's brother had decided fighting young Scipio in Spain would be counterproductive and made the decision to leave Spain for Italy. The best way to regain the upper hand in Spain, he figured, was to deal the Romans another crushing blow in Italy. But that was the plan hatched between the two Baracca brothers. The Carthaginian Senate, on the other hand, was not ready to cede Spain to Scipio quite so easily and sent 50,000 reinforcements to defeat the young, dynamic Roman general. In 206 BC, the two sides met near Alypia. The battle that followed would be, tactically at least, Scipio's finest hour. Outnumbering the Romans by a sizable margin, the Carthaginians were confident they could beat the so far undefeated Scipio. But the Roman general, taking a page from Hannibal's playbook, employed a clever trick that turned a long-shot win into an easy victory. Each morning, the two sides would line up for battle and wait for the other to make a move, and each day neither would budge and the day would pass without a battle. When Scipio deployed his troops, he concentrated the core of the legions in the center and placed his Spanish allies on the wings. The opposing Carthaginian general got used to this formation and placed his strongest troops in the center and his own weaker Spanish mercenaries on the wings. On the morning Scipio had decided to fight, however, he switched things up. But first, he took revenge on the Carthaginians for the Roman defeat at Trebia, a battle Scipio was very likely at. He ordered out his cavalry early in the morning to attack the Carthaginian camp. In a reverse of the previous battle, this time it was the Carthaginians who were roused from their beds and forced to charge out without a good breakfast. They formed for battle in the usual line, but the Romans, as I said, switched things up. Scipio put the Spanish in the center and deployed the legions on the wings. When the Carthaginian general did not notice the switch, Scipio knew victory was his for the taking. He waited most of the day while the Carthaginians suffered, hungry and tired, under the hot afternoon sun, and then ordered the attack. The Roman wings led the charge, easily destroying the overmatched, opposing Spanish wings. The Libyans and Carthaginians at the center of the other army suddenly found themselves flanked on both sides by the Romans. In the confusion, they didn't even charge forward to attack the Roman center, made up of the weak Spanish mercenaries, where they may have won an escape route. Instead, they stayed put and were caught in a pincer. The only thing that saved them was that the weather turned ugly and rain turned the field into a mud-clogged morass. The Carthaginians were able to escape, but their will was broken. Hannibal pursued the fleeing army and destroyed them a few weeks later. When Scipio entered Spain, the Carthaginians controlled practically the entire country. But now the Romans were the undisputed masters. Carthaginian influence in Spain was over, and in a few years hence, the Great War itself would be over as well. Scipio now had all the clout he needed to take his master plan to the Senate. There would be fierce resistance for his idea of an African invasion, but Scipio's charisma and track record would carry the day. Next week, we will follow Hasdrubal in his desperate effort to link up with his brother in Italy and form an army large enough to attack Rome. I don't think I'll be giving anything away by revealing Hasdrubal was stopped in the last pivotal battle of the war fought in Italy. Without hope of reinforcement, Hannibal's decade-long invasion would run out of steam, and he would be recalled when the Romans decided to take another chance on Scipio and authorize his invasion of Africa. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. Episode 23E, The War with Hannibal. Though neither side was aware of it, the long war between Rome and Carthage was marching inexorably towards a final conclusion. For the Romans, the scourge of Hannibal seemed a virus they would never be able to purge from their body. Not strong enough to conquer the Romans, yet too strong to just be driven off, Hannibal had wreaked havoc in Italy for a decade, and there was no indication he would ever leave. The Fabian strategy of countering Hannibal's political moves without risking open battle was by now firmly entrenched. Even those commanders who broke from this tradition found themselves chasing after a ghost. Hannibal would never fight a battle not of his own devising, and stayed forever one step ahead of Roman pursuit. Hannibal himself knew that things could not go on like this forever. The Carthaginian Senate was growing weary of the war. Supplies and reinforcements were produced in ever-shrinking amounts after ever more cajoling. If things kept going in this direction, Hannibal would find himself isolated in enemy territory, abandoned by his country. It was fast turning into a replay of his father's war in Sicily. Hannibal could see the writing on the wall. He did not have the money or manpower to launch a decisive offensive, even if the shell-shocked Romans still went to bed in fear of the Carthaginian army pouring through the gates while they slept. But entering 207 BC, the 11th year since Hannibal had left New Carthage for Italy, the Carthaginian commander still had hope of a successful conclusion. His brother Hasdrubal had left Spain after tangling with young Scipio and was making his way across Gaul, through the Alps, and would soon be in Italy with an army of 30,000. If the two brothers were able to link up, they would form an army that could overrun anything the Romans sent against them. The Romans were not ignorant of the threat they faced from this second invading army. When Hasdrubal passed into the Po Valley, he was immediately shadowed by two Roman legions, led by one of the consuls for the year, Marcus Livius. Livius kept to the high ground, not having enough troops to openly confront Hasdrubal, but hoping to at least forestall the Carthaginians if they attempted to move further south. Hasdrubal, knowing there was no army in the area who could match him, moved confidently through the Italian countryside, picking up Gallic allies and waiting for word from his brother on where to meet up. The other consul for the year, Gaius Claudius Nero, was encamped with his army some 250 miles south, keeping watch on Hannibal. He knew that neither his army nor Livius's in the north could halt the movement of the Carthaginian armies they each shadowed. Only if they were able to concentrate Roman force against one or the other could they hope to prevent the disaster of a combined Carthaginian army. So Nero made a snap decision and embarked on an incredibly risky adventure. Leaving a token force in camp to keep up appearances, he ordered the bulk of his army out in the middle of the night and force-marched them north to link up with Livius and hopefully annihilate Hasdrubal before Hannibal caught wind of the plan. Roman luck held, and Nero was able to close the 250-mile gap in a mere 7 days, with his troops left behind tending multiple fires and manning round-the-clock guard duty, so Hannibal would believe a full Roman army was still encamped. Nero linked up with Livius and marched his troops into his colleague's camp at night. Though the Romans tried to keep this arrival secret, word soon leaked to Hasdrubal of the numerically superior enemy he now faced, and he attempted to withdraw, making his way along the Metaurus River. The two consular armies took off at once in pursuit, and were soon able to trap Hasdrubal's tired army against the river. The battle that followed turned from an equal engagement into a rout, when Nero led a portion of his troops around behind the Carthaginians and surprised their rear. Hasdrubal, knowing the end was near, charged out in the middle of the battle and died fighting. The hope of a Carthaginian super army died there on the banks of the Metaurus. Hannibal's last best hope to conquer the Romans died with it. The Romans were ecstatic at the news. It was the first major battle in Italy the Romans had actually won. And to young Scipio, returning from his command in Spain, word of the victory was music to his ears. The high spirits of his countrymen and low threat level now posed by Hannibal produced the exact psychological environment Scipio needed to ensure a receptive audience for his plan of a North African invasion. In 205 BC, Scipio went before the Senate and pitched his idea. The time had come, he argued, to return to the original strategy abandoned at the outset of the war. The fight had to be taken to the Carthaginians. Hannibal would not be driven off by direct action. The only way to be rid of him was to attack Carthage and force the Carthaginian Senate to recall Hannibal to protect the mother city. But Scipio was not without detractors in the Senate, chief amongst them old Marcus Fabius, now 70 years old. What Scipio pitched was the exact opposite of everything Fabius stood for. The old warhorse argued that with Hasdrubal's defeat, the Romans should stick with the limited objective of re-securing the Po Valley and continuing the war of attrition against Hannibal, that though lacking the flash of Scipio's bold plan, had proved so successful. Generational tensions played out, with Scipio accusing old Fabius of being too cautious and stuck in his ways, and Fabius reminding young Scipio that had it not been for caution, Rome would have fallen a decade earlier. But the aura of Scipio carried the day, and, with reservations attached, he was more or less given the go-ahead for his invasion. The young Roman general embarked for Sicily, where he began to make his preparations, building a fleet and gathering troops. Of vital importance was a mission he assigned to Laelius, the naval commander who had been in Scipio's confidence at the siege of New Carthage. The most formidable part of the Carthaginian army, everyone knew, was the Numidian cavalry. They could not be matched in speed or skill, and as long as they remained in the opposing line, the legions would always be in danger. Scipio knew something of North African politics, though, and hoped to turn a clear weakness into an advantage. Laelius's mission was to sail to North Africa and turn the Numidians to the Roman side. The Numidians, you must understand, were not Carthaginians. They were a client state of Carthage and had long chafed under Carthaginian rule. Though the leadership seemed more or less content to stick with Carthage, there was an undercurrent of dissatisfaction that always threatened to come to the surface. In North Africa, Laelius made contact with the exiled Numidian prince Massinissa, who had fought against Scipio in Spain, and confirmed that he was ready and willing to lead his followers in revolt, both against his own king and the Carthaginians. In the years to come, Massinissa would remain a staunch ally of Rome, matching in many ways the friendship of Hiero. Certainly in longevity, a young man at the time of the Second Punic War, Massinissa would reign over Numidia for 50 years, nipping in the bud any trouble posed to the Romans from Africa. Scipio sailed for North Africa in 203 BC with a force of about 35,000. His aim was to end the war or die trying. When the Romans landed, they immediately swept through the land west of Carthage, taking prisoners and sacking towns. Scipio had his eye on the major city of Utica, and in the autumn of 203, he besieged the city. The Carthaginians sent a massive army against Scipio, reportedly in excess of 70,000 troops, to drive the Romans off. Scipio prudently withdrew, and, to throw the Carthaginians off, he opened peace negotiations. While the talks commenced, though, Scipio scouted his enemy and formulated a plan to beat them without having to take the field against a far larger army. The fake talks concluded, Scipio sent a portion of his troops back to Utica to feign a return to the siege. However, while the unsuspecting Carthaginians slept, content to arise the next morning and overwhelm the Roman pest, Scipio dispatched the bulk of his army towards the enemy camp. Under cover of darkness, they started fires all over the camp and waited by the exits. The alarm was raised, and when the panicked soldiers came pouring out of the gates, they were slaughtered by the Romans. Those who were not killed by the Romans died in the fire. It was a horrible and bloody affair, but just like that, Scipio had destroyed most of the Carthaginian army in North Africa. The Carthaginians regrouped, however, and made one last go of it. but at a place called Great Plains, Scipio routed them, and Carthage found itself suddenly without an army in the field, not unlike the Romans had found themselves after Cannae so many years before. At this point, the Carthaginian Senate was left with no choice. Hannibal had to be recalled. Envoys were sent to Italy in 202 to bring him back. With tears streaming from his one good eye, Hannibal reluctantly ordered his army to board the ship sent to retrieve them. After 16 years, the death of his brothers, and an endless series of maneuvers designed to bring the Romans to their knees, he was being pulled out of Italy no closer to his goal than when he started. His life's work had been for naught. It was an exhausted and psychologically wounded Hannibal who returned to North Africa. He would fight bravely there, and no historian faults any of the decisions he made while battling Scipio. But clearly, the imaginative genius who had so flummoxed the Romans early in the war was gone. All the vital energy was in the confident hands of Scipio, and both of them seemed to know it. After his victories near the coast, and with the knowledge of Hannibal's return, Scipio did not make for Carthage, but rather marched inland. The interior of North Africa was hostile territory, not just for the Romans, but for the Carthaginians as well. The land was populated with subject people of dubious Carthaginian loyalty, but nonetheless, they were a critical source of supplies for the city. Scipio hoped to draw Hannibal into unfriendly territory by threatening Carthage with starvation. Hannibal himself despaired at the situation. He had to make a move against Scipio, but the troops he had at his disposal were not even close to a match for the Romans. He had his corps of veterans, but the rest were recent recruits, ill-trained and passionless. He argued against leading such a weak army out, but was overruled by the Senate, who ordered him to track down Scipio and defeat him. And, always the good soldier, Hannibal did as he was told. The two armies met at Zama, 100 or so miles southwest of Carthage. Prior to any armed confrontation, the two great generals met. Hannibal attempted to secure a favorable peace, knowing his own troops were ill-equipped to deal with the Romans, but Scipio would have none of it. After acknowledging the respect each had for the other, they departed back to their own tents to prepare for the final battle. Lining up in the morning, Hannibal placed his raw recruits in the front line with his veterans behind. This way, the new troops would have no place to run if they tried to retreat, and, if Hannibal was lucky, they would tire the legionaries out and allow the Carthaginian veterans to sweep through. He also placed his war elephants, the old Carthaginian juggernaut, at the head of the army. But Scipio was well prepared for the elephants and positioned his men so that lanes were open all the way through the lines. When the elephants charged, they passed by harmlessly. The battle begun. Rome scored a victory that had eluded them the entire war. Massinissa's allied Numidian cavalry was able to drive off their Carthaginian counterparts, suddenly leaving Hannibal rather than the Romans without support. Just as he predicted, the experienced Romans cut through Hannibal's new soldiers. But a total rout was prevented by the strength of his veterans who blunted the Romans' advance. The war hung in the balance as two of the greatest strategic and tactical geniuses in history oversaw an unimaginative clash of brute force. When the Roman cavalry returned to attack the Carthaginian rear, the battle turned decisively against Hannibal. His army was broken, and the great Carthaginian general was forced to withdraw in defeat. The Battle of Zama was over. So too was the Second Punic War. Carthage offered no further resistance and accepted punishing terms. While allowed to keep possessions in North Africa, the dream of a Carthaginian empire overseas was crushed and all holdings forfeited to the Romans. Carthage was not allowed to equip an army or a navy, nor allowed to engage in any hostilities with their neighbors without explicit Roman permission. For his loyalty, Massinissa was granted control over an independent Numidian kingdom that would be the dominant force in North Africa for years to come. Finally, a huge punitive fine was laid on Carthage to be paid off in no less than 50 years. In a final irony, it was Hannibal who put a stop to any call for further resistance and demanded that the Senate accept Roman terms. Carthage was defeated. There was nothing left to be said about it. The Romans had paid an enormous price for their victory. The population of Rome declined by something like 17% over the course of the war, and the treasury was all but empty. But they had won an immeasurably valuable prize: uncontested control of the entire Western Mediterranean. The Roman Empire as we now know it, the greatest power in the ancient world, and one of the farthest-reaching land empires in history, was born on that day at Zama in 202 BC. Some also claim, as I said at the outset of this series of episodes, that the victory over Carthage also marked the death of old Roman virtue. Certainly, there's much to be said for the theory that the Republic was not long for this world after Rome lost its greatest enemy. Over the course of the war, the power of the Senate had grown to far exceed the people's assemblies, and democracy, such as it had existed, was a thing of the past. The Republic was now a true aristocratic oligarchy. The Senate was firmly in control of Rome, and would be for the rest of the life of the Republic. But soon the egos of the foremost families in Rome began to grow unchecked, and men emerged every day who had no truck with the old restraint shown by their forefathers. Scipio had inadvertently introduced the cult of personality to the Romans, and the coming age of troubles would revolve around powerful men who put their own ambition above that of some withered sense of propriety. The Gracchi brothers, Marius, Sulla, Julius Caesar, Pompey, and finally Augustus, would drive Roman politics in the coming years. They took their cues from Scipio, who was nearly deified in his lifetime, rather than the string of forgotten consuls who preserved tradition in anonymity. Further, these latter-day Roman leaders never dealt with the humility of facing an external threat that checked their boundless egos. Control of Rome now meant control of the whole world. What chance did the Republic have when absolute power was at stake? I will be out of town next week, so we will leave the Romans here at the moment of their greatest triumph. Next time, in 2 weeks, we will enter a new era of Roman history as Rome looks east to the great civilizations of Greece. Contact with Greece would forever alter the character of the Romans, as they were introduced to the luxury, philosophy, art, and science of the East. The marriage of East and West would be proposed on the battlefield, but it would be consummated in the minds of the victorious Romans, who became open to ideas that would have made their frugal and virtuous ancestors shudder.